Nihilistic.
Optimistic.
Nihilistic.
Optimistic.
Nihilistic.
Optimistic.
Nihilistic.
And there is a part of you that constantly wonders whether it is worth staying in politics because of all the rubbish that you have to do. I mean, you...
Optimistic.
You just have to do it.
Nihilistic.
You've just got to keep a grip of yourself and hope that your humanity sees you through and...
Free. Cash.
Come over here and let's have a look. How's my voice now, speaking like this? What's my signal? So maybe you should put it higher when we're doing together. See what I'm saying? Yep. So, like, I'm just, like, blabbering. I'm not speaking directly to the thing because it's tied on my shoulder, you see? It's tied on my shoulder. So then you'll stand next to me shoulder to shoulder, you see what I'm saying? And then, you know, it's trying to catch both of us.
Hello, it's Ruth and Adam.
Hello, hey, it's Ruth and Adam.
We're chatting.
I've
got some notes, I'm going to put them here, and now I'm going to go
welcome
back
to... Welfare to Artwork.
Volume.
Do you want to just listen to what that was like?
It's a bit loud.
Is it a bit loud? This is Welfare to Artwork number 4. Sorry.
Why are you not talking?
Wait a second. The thing's not standing safely, Ruth.
What are you doing? Why are you playing with a small piece of sausage?
I'm not playing with it. I'm trying to eat it.
Well, can we record when you're munching sausage?
I'm recording it now.
I'll turn it off if you're doing that.
We should start a show like that.
Should we include the recording of us eating a pie and talking about the YBX?
Yeah, should we try that?
Okay.
Don't like ignorant minds like Kesseltine. I always host a Crella Peter Sissons on Question Time. And when I rhyme, you know what's the time. Criticize this and I blow up like a landmine. I forecast the blast with lyrics that kick ass. Or intelligent glass, a mastermind I never pass. So to the critics that put us in doubt, you can't knock us out, cause we come back with a return bout. Dishing out criticism, you're called to advice. Do you think that I'm stupid? Like an like a rice? Nah, you're unconstructive, more like destructive. Putting us down, saying we ain't productive. Missing our rap styles, our beats and our grooves. Get the hell out, just move, cause we got nothing to prove.
They try to analyze, criticize. They try to analyze, scandalize. They try to analyze, criticize, scandalize. They try to analyze, scandalize.
Dear Angela and Esther, does it help to be poor or working class? Lots of YBAs were.
Nothing it is. No. career artist. Not anymore. Everyone has to pay for art education now. I think that the ruling class is going to be the one who can afford to go to art school now. Before, it was more interesting. Lots of YBAs pretended to be poor or working class to sound authentic or cool. But before the early 90s, a lot of working class people actually did go to art school because it was free and they were financially supported with fees, even housing, etc., by the state. It was very good to be an artist at that time. Angela and Esther.
Hello!
Hey! It's Ruthane Jedwin.
And Adam Gallagher.
We're back for our fourth instalment of the Welfare to Artwork series.
Series. So, it's been really nice revisiting some of the previous shows because it's now been about a year since we started making the Welfare to Artwork series.
I can't believe it's been a year.
And it's been about 6 months since we made the last one.
Since the last episode, lots has happened in the world and in our life.
Big news for us is we're no longer on benefits.
Can you believe it?
Gainfully employed.
I know, I don't know how we did it.
So in the last episode, we looked quite a lot at the Kill the Bill protests in 1994, when the Criminal Justice Bill came in, and the effect that that had on people's freedoms in the UK. Since then, we've had Kill the Bill round two. As we predicted, the government seems to be using the COVID crisis in an opportunistic way to try and seize power and take away our rights to protest for good.
We cannot let this happen.
And also, in another weird kind of
plot twist,
having done the last show, a lot of it looking into the New Age Travellers.
New Age Travellers and their demonisation and scapegoating and culture.
With the Criminal Justice Bill, we've now moved out of the church and onto a boat.
In the sense that we're now technically travellers.
Yay! Unlike the last two episodes, we don't have any interviews in this one.
We did have some planned, but there's just so much to get through, but we're going to save that for next time.
So bear with us on this one. You might have to listen to quite a lot of mine and Adam's voices. But don't worry, we've got some really great interviews coming up on the next one.
Thatcher was in full stride and the art scene in London in the mid-1980s felt dull and not about radical ideas anymore. Instead, it felt centred on an awkward club of artists and institutions who went about their business as usual. No one talked publicly about art because it was embarrassing. To aspire to be an artist or even to be interested in art was considered a waste of time. To have a job as an artist was a virtual impossibility. A fine art vocation in the UK was not an option. You got the impression from your tutor's view of the world that even if after years of art school, which in those days you even got a grant for, you managed to survive for 5 years making art, perhaps on the dole, you might just get a chance to exhibit in a real gallery. Malcolm McLaren summed it up. At art schools, they trained everybody for failure.
Cue smarmy arty bit. However, in such stagnant ponds, interesting stuff happens. Some of my fellow art students, encouraged by more radical teachers and each other, were getting stuck into various Marxist writings. The Frankfurt School, with its critique of cultural mass production. Semiotex were publishing books that highlighted the simulacrum, and the way that the society of spectacle had engulfed the world so completely that now only the meagre shadow of reality was visible. The postmodernism of Jean-François Lyotard and Jacques Derrida and the social anthropology of Michel Foucault were starting to bleed into the way art was being discussed and developed.
All this cutting-edge critical theory, that in today's world of fake news, social media, manipulating populists, reality TV stars and journalists as leaders of the free world, as well as a terrifying background of ecological breakdown, seems frighteningly prescient. But at the time, we all felt we were discovering the pattern of DNA. In the wider arena, fine art courses were beginning to be restructured, and the restricted divisions of painting, sculpture, printmaking and new media were being broken down. This, in turn, helped to free up thinking and flatten the restrictive hierarchies of class, race, gender, and gave confidence to a growing band of outsiders and iconoclasts.
I don't know if that's true, you know.
This episode focuses on the decade of the 90s, a time when Thatcher's children, the YBAs, Britpop, Jungle, those that missed out on punk, used the spirit of the 80s to sell a DIY vision of authentic cultural production, mostly accepting the selfish pursuit of celebrity and careerism as opposed to creative and political virtue, though there are exceptions. Between shifting policy, the initial hope of new labour, and a successful export of cool Britannia nationalism, the very British class contradictions are revealed, and a peculiar and deeply cynical working class drag is used to push the neoliberal agenda.
Nationalism was being abstracted. Who had claimants on Britain's identity and soul? Tony Blair said he was rebranding Britain, as Britpop claimed it was redefining it. And simultaneously, Jungle, coming out of drum and bass and the rave scene, artists such as Goldie, Asian Dub Foundation and UK Apache would have a different take on British identity. A contradictory and diverse pride was summoned, that what it was to be British was up for grabs.
Following a wave of protests, Thatcher wound up on her iron horse, leaving Downing Street crying tears down her face, which she'd never done before, in case it rusted.
The next Prime Minister, Major John, was as fearsome as he looked, and he presided over yet another depressing period of recession. Britain was in a right state, not only financially, but also economically and in money terms too. The only hope was that we could somehow paint and sing our way out.
There is no way of knowing if Damien Hirst is serious or a prankster, a charlatan or the greatest artist of today. There is absolutely no way we can know. We have to judge it. We have to use our intuition to see. And as far as I'm concerned, I think he's a very amiable chancer. I wouldn't describe him as a charlatan because I've spoken to him and I think he is serious about what he does quite a lot of the time. But I think he has made a very limited talent go a very long way.
Real art has always dealt, has never failed to deal with difficult issues, issues of reality, some of which are quite difficult to face.
The great British public at large is shockingly ignorant about the state of modern art.
In some way, you know, horrid or not necessary or gratuitous.
And they're shockingly unwelcoming about people who try, or two people who try and do new things. Now, I'm far more shocked by that. I'm far more shocked by some of the reactions you read in the gutter press, celebrating the comments you read from people who call themselves serious art critics. I'm far more shocked by that than anything I've ever seen in the show itself.
An extraordinary patron.
A frequent criticism of the genre is that anyone can do it. And while this may not be quite the point, it is true that any butcher worth his salt could have created Mother and Child Divided. Not that this particular one would have bothered.
They do silly things, you know, they either get paid silly money for it, meaning a lot, or they get paid nothing for it. I mean, they want to do things that are out of beef, it's up to them, isn't it? I mean, you're never going to fetch the same price as that that goes out, you know, to eat. It's, you know, it's only an artist that can get such a
ridiculous. After all this began on with the animal rights, someone comes away and gets £20,000 for cutting an animal in half. It's absolutely crazy. It's not even art, is it?
Predictable reactions, perhaps. But outside the market, a taxi driver, unpredictably, gave a more measured response.
It's a weird, unusual thought in the first place. To think of actually doing that with a cow as a form of art is a little bit unusual.
Exactly. Paul George, Channel 1, Central London.
Come the 90s, the sublimated love affair of the left and the arts community with the Dole queue was fading as economic prosperity, along with the rebranding of Dolies as job seekers and employment offices as job centres, did much to destigmatise and, in an odd way, deglamorise for those who idealised the so-called authentic working class experience, the experience of being on the dole.
Grandma needs new dentures to eat the crust on pizza. Taken out by her daughter because she put your water. Kids are eating Snickers because they're so delicious. Then there's sticky fingers.
The mother loses her finger.
But I'll die come 6 times a year. Let's have a joint or two which everyone cheers. But I'll die come 6 pack of beer. And it's back to work. I-G.
The Gallagher brothers were lad culture incarnate, whereas Damon Albarn tried his own slightly intellectual version. I started out reading Nabokov, he said. Now I'm into football, dog racing and Essex Girls.
I just think it was sort of like a, it was that sort of laddish subculture coming around in almost like a cyclical fashion. And it was interesting because all that stuff was very much sort of couched in postmodernism, which so much of Britpop was, which is kind of, well, are we playing with it? Do we mean that really? Or are we just kind of messing with it? Do we mean it seriously? Which is kind of a sort of get out concept.
Blair was Prime Minister and leader of the Labour Party, and there was one of the biggest rock or pop bands of the time was Blur. Blur.
Yeah. It's hard to remember today, but Blur and Blur were actually two different things. Blur were a rock band locked into a notorious rivalry with Oasis. Oasis were rough and tumble lads from Manchester, whereas Blur were from art school,
which is the opposite of Manchester, and that's why they hated each other.
Tony Blur, meanwhile, was a guitarist and Dee Ream fan who reinvented the Labour Party and rode it to victory at the election. Blur hosted a party at Number 10, inviting lots of the Cool Britannia crowd and immediately making them much less cool. Anyone who was a massive prick was there.
From 1997, the dominant political representation of the working class shifted subtly in appearance, if not in political practice and policy, under Tony Blair's neoliberal New Labour. Although as predominantly middle class and privately educated as the Conservatives, New Labour performed an appropriation of working class culture to recast their party as more in touch and with the people than the previous government. Their appropriation of stereotypical working class signifiers, filtered down to middle class actors, musicians, artists and people in the media, who performed an artificial downward mobility in the form of mimicry of working class youth speech, colloquial accents and dress, most evidently seen in the use of Britpop as a marker of a new cool Britannia that relied on exploiting the sceptre of poverty to connote down-to-earthness. Where else would a band such as Pulp be able to have a hit single in 1995 with Common People, a song about a rich girl slumming it at Central St Martin's? Artists who came of age in the 1990s were amongst the last generation to enjoy free higher education. The 1944 Education Act had opened the doors of art schools to those from lower income backgrounds, legislation that was to have a major impact on the kind of art and pop music made in Britain from the early 60s through to art of the 1990s. Class solidarity and upward and downward mobility through professional success or class drag was a topic for work and a target of criticism, sometimes both. The range of economic backgrounds represented in British contemporary art was perhaps wider back then.
That worked against us, obviously.
Yeah.
Musically, we're the very antithesis of what that was all about.
Yeah.
You know.
we're forward-looking, we're leaping backwards, you know what I mean? We're about, you know, we have a more cultural, socially conscious, you know, perspective, whereas that has none. You know,
we make use of current technology. Not just guitar.
You know, we don't believe in golden eras of music, you know what I mean? But every era and people has the ability to make, you know, fantastic music, wherever you start from, you know, rather than some kind of myth of some British superiority, which is what all that was about.
But at the same time, the Britpop scene did give a lot of focus to the English musicians.
To the English, well,
yeah, but it was very
to
much
a version of
defined.
English.
That
yeah.
was a bit of a problem in that. The definition of what was British tended to be white music, rock music, and ignored the wonderful music that was developed up at the time, like the jungle music, it avoided all that. And the dance music was blowing up in all different directions. And so they just focused on one thing. And
so was like the biggest like swing.
It ignored all this new music was coming up, and by that, culturally, it ignored the presence of black people in Britain. And so
and then when they did this Britpop thing, they brought the flag.
So suddenly it was Union Jacks everywhere. And it sort of like, and it was a cultural metaphor for like what was happening in Britain, the Labour government coming in, which ignored the rest of the communities that make up Britain and have always made up Britain, you know? So for us it meant that we didn't really have the time there, so we didn't have opportunities there, so we were in Europe a lot more. So that for us, we just weren't connected and we just thought, well, nothing can stop us.
You can't really say that in 95, it was just then, even now.
The jungle, because it's from England, right? I can really relate to it. It's important to me because I'm born here. I'm from England and London, and nobody can't tell me that I'm not from here. It's like, I think one time I was going around, I was like, ashamed of being British. Yeah, we've got Woolworths, Marks and Spencers, Sparks. And it's like the jungle's drawn me back into my roots, where I'm from. Because though my parents are from, like, I'm half Arab, half Asian, African, I can relate to those countries only up to a point. Like when I talk to my children or whatever, I can't talk to them about Africa. I can't talk to them about where my dad's from because my life has not been there. My life has been in England, London. I have to talk to them about Ballantine, where I'm from. So if you're born in England, be proud of it. And don't make nobody tell you no different, no BNP or anything like that. The jungle is British. That's a real relationship.
It goes back to my argument about the redefinition of Britishness, a sense of Britishness, the British nation and British culture. For the first time, you're probably seeing all of those things being redefined
and the artists.
On black terms.
Now, because most of the music you hear, you won't see live PAs
a radical
for this jungle, apart from leaving.
From what you've witnessed before.
They have to buy the records, the vinyl, and the DJs are playing the vinyl, so it's down to the DJs to influence the music. They can either kill it or take it somewhere else.
Yeah, I'll mix this one for you.
Because I like you so much, you're such a good DJ.
The close-knit DJ fraternity is suspicious of Jungle's imminent explosion into the mainstream.
What's happening, guys? Right, Trace?
Right, easy. Ready?
Yeah. Right, rhyme time?
Yeah. 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 Right, Steve, man.
Yeah, man. Good.
Right.
Oh,
cheers. Thank you. It's a youthful music. And it's not for the charts, you know, it's our music and we built it, do you know what I mean? And I don't want to see all the major people jumping on it and exploiting it, you know? People have tried to cross it over into the mainstream, and for me that just loses the whole flavour and the idea of the music, you know? It's an underground vibe, that's the way it should stay, do you know what I mean?
True to the spirit of Jungle, last week Shy turned down a six-figure sum for a contract from one of the major record companies. Instead, he's releasing his tunes through a small independent label, Sounds of the Underground, who have promised him greater artistic control. Virtually all Jungle is still marketed through small independents.
I think even the constructors and majors, they don't really care. They'll tell you that they don't care, really, at the end of the day. You know, as long as they can make money off you, that's all that really matters. A lot of people are weary, they know, you know, even from people like George Michael, if you see him kind of like getting distressed by his record company, you can imagine, and he's one of the biggest artists of all kinds of music in the world. You know what I mean? And some little boys from Brixton or wherever, they know they're going to get manipulated. At the end of the day, I just think that I hope a lot of them ain't silly enough to kind of not get anything out of it themselves.
EMI is an international company with top artists on their books. Their A&R manager, DJ Elaine,
you know, I'm not quite sure why a lot of the guys down there don't want it to go commercial, but, you know, I think in every field you'll find that a lot of people that originate stuff and whatever, they get a bit kind of green or whatever with envy because someone else is kind of crossed over.
Renk Records is a small independent label. They signed General Levy to perform Incredible, which immediately hit the top 40. With the remix currently in the top 10, Ant makes no apologies for their mainstream success.
After they found that the track had actually done quite well on the underground, then it, you know, it appeared to them that they should actually try and do something much more important with it, like take that to that step where they could get it into literally every shot. You can get a real feeling of how jungle is, and it also gets away from the fact that jungle, you know, is made by people in bedrooms, and you know, you actually get to hear the records and vinyls, and that's it. This is actually bringing it a step closer to, you know, getting to know who the artists are.
Yo, have the whole of them and spin them like a windmill. You talk with them.
When Incredible first broke into the charts, rumour spread that the former reggae artist was calling himself the King of Jungle. Pirate Station boycotted the tune, saying that he was selling their music out to the mainstream.
Jungle actually is something, it's the only thing which black people from the streets of London, as well as whites, it's the only thing which whites and blacks from the streets have made together, and they've actually...
Isabella just took on, you know, where the school left off. I mean, she bought his collection. She wore it. She promoted him. She talked about him. As far as I know, he stayed in her house. She's been incredible, and I think she's helped him quite enormously.
These designers think that you made me. And she,
no,
it's never been about...
No, they don't. I know that
that... What did they do? Because you see, you see it all the time in the press. You see them like, oh, Isabella Blow responsible for Philip Treacy and Alexander McQueen?
No, they say...
They do say that. But the thing is, it's never been about that for me and you.
Does that really annoy you, that they always put this little strap, as discovered by Isabella Blow? Does it really piss you off?
No, not at all, because Izzy has helped me a lot in that way, but not in a way that she's sort of like... You know, she does it because she loves my clothes, not because she loves me.
Exactly. That's the point.
Oh.
Because I can't stand her guts. Joke.
I just knew that he had something really special, very modern. It was about sabotage and tradition, which is the perfect combination, and beauty, violence, all the things that I suppose the 90s represent.
McQueen was to become the most controversial designer of the 90s. Making his name with the plunging waistlines of the bumpster trouser.
I had to elongate the abdomen, and the only way to do that was to bring the waistline down to the possible bare minimum. My focus was on the front of the body, not on the back. And the good old British press loved to make something out of nothing, and it's sort of like it was gorgeous bum, and it's like a builder's bum, and actually they're not appealing at all, not even to a gay man, I'm afraid.
He comes up here about four times a year, maybe half a dozen, and he completely takes it over, arrives, it becomes his office, and it becomes his sort of play den.
and he relaxes and he feels very at home.
He just loves it up there. He just finds it so relaxing. I think he just goes into another world when he's up there, especially when he's with his birds.
This thing about nature, I get lots of inspiration from nature itself. It comes a lot in my work, really. I mean, it's a big aesthetic for me, so I work on that a lot. The old show feeling was about the Thompson gazelle. It's a poor little critter. The markings are lovely. It's got these dark eyes here, the white of the belly, then the black line going across, then the tan, the horns. But it is the food chain of Africa. As soon as it's born, it's dead. I mean, you're lucky if it lasts a few months. And that's how I see human life, in the same way. You know, we can all be discarded quite easily, and nothing depicts it more honestly than the way animals are. And I was trying to also say the fragility of a designer's time in the press. There you've gone. It's a jungle out there.
There's a sense in which I just feel people have got to understand things can change. I mean, it's just so daft to think they couldn't be better.
Culturepreneur, another bastardized nouveau noun, this time culture and entrepreneur. It is, according to the website of a marketing and promotions company, as the dialogue between the arts and business.
Benefits, bills, and when I talk about getting young people off benefit and into work, it's not saying they'd be uncaring. On the contrary, the only proper, true, compassionate way to care is to say we're going to do something about that.
As a first step, we will implement a program to take 250,000 young people off benefit and into work, funded by a one-off windfall levy on the excess profits of the privatised monopoly utility.
What? I Spy is probably one of the most savage songs that I've ever written. It's definitely the most vindictive. I wrote it about that time I was on the dole in Sheffield. Sometimes if you're in a real cocky mood, you can walk down the street and kind of despise the people from above. You know, that kind of superior hate. There you are, walking down the street, and everyone just thinks you're this useless, jobless piece of crap. But inside, you feel really strong. The hatred sort of helps you feel that way. You know what's going on. You've got their number. You know you're going to get your own back someday. I think it's important to acknowledge that you've got these feelings inside you. It's usually when you don't admit to those things or fail to recognise them that they build up and explode.
Oh, you didn't do bad. You made it out. I'm still stuck here. Oh, but I'll get out. Oh, yeah, I'll get out. Can't you see giant walks among you, see through your petty lies? Things just so I survive. And you know I will survive. It may look to the untrained eye, I'm sitting on my arse all day. And biding time until I take it all on. I want to please, I will prevail. I cannot fail, cause I survive.
Years, the DSS has puzzled over the problem of reducing Britain's welfare bill. Now it seems to be abandoning its half-hearted attempts to lure people into work in favour of forced labour. Yet the answer to its problem is so painfully obvious that it could only have been deliberately ignored. To get people off the dole, you pay them more. It was in the context described above that the Job Seekers Allowance, JSA, took shape. The JSA, which consolidated unemployment benefit, contribution-based and income support, means-tested, in October 1996, has a number of features, the following perhaps being the most significant.
The cutting of contribution-based benefits from 12 to 6 months. A contract, the Job Seekers Agreement, such that the claimant must search for a given number of jobs each week and must, on demand, produce evidence of their job seeking. Increased sanctions for not actively seeking work. Loss of all unemployed benefits for set periods rather than just a proportion as it was in the past. The ability of client advisers to issue directives telling claimants to apply for particular jobs or to make themselves as presentable, even including haircuts and removal of earrings, on pain of sanctions.
Although the immediate aim of the JSA was to save money by restricting the numbers of claimants, it was also a major change in the very nature of welfare administration, designed to put pressure on the unemployed to compete on the labour market and thereby undermine the general level of wages and conditions of those in work. It also paved the way for workfare. Under the old system, the unemployed only had to satisfy a number of general conditions in order to receive benefits. With the JSA, in addition to such general conditions, certain individual conditions can also be imposed at the discretion of the client advisers. In order to ensure that such discretion is not used too leniently, claimant reduction targets are imposed on individual workers, sections and offices within the employment service.
Oh,
introduction of the Job Seekers Allowance, which is withheld if people seem reluctant to take employment, has already caused appalling hardship. The Salvation Army and the Citizens Advice Bureau have been handing out food parcels to people who have been arbitrarily deprived of benefits. Young artists and musicians trying to build their careers have been cut short. Even athletes at this year's Commonwealth Games were told that their JSA would be discontinued as they had not stayed in Britain to make themselves available for work. There are also many welfare recipients who would like to take paid employment, but know that, with poor wages and miserable conditions, it would do nothing for their quality of life. The government's social security plans were revealed just 2 days after Peter Mandelson hinted that its fairness at work proposals will be watered down. While working conditions remain manifestly unfair, and while the proposed minimum wage is set at little more than half the European Union decency threshold, the Department of Social Security is becoming the enforcer for exploitative employers, compelling people to take work that no one who could exercise a choice would accept. The government is running a protection racket. You work for the boss, or we break your piggy bank.
Here I'm stood outside what used to be one of my favourite nightclubs in the world, The End. We used to do Twice as Nice here every Sunday night. All the stars of the garage scene came down and played. It wasn't just people in London. People used to come from Manchester and Liverpool and Birmingham and Bristol and Southampton on a Sunday, rave until 3 o'clock, get back in their car, drive back to their hometown, Cardiff, and go to work. It's incredible. I mean,
in Manchester, after the IRA bomb of 1996 and before the financial crash of 2008, property development became the new punk rock. The old entrepreneurs built the mills where workers toiled at 12-hour shifts and died before they were 40. The new entrepreneurs sold the same mills to young urban professionals as luxury housing, with rooms half the size of the old council flats.
I mean, now this is, if we think for the End, seeing the club that is no longer a club. What used to be a club is not even a building anymore. It will be a series of 1, 2, 3 bedroom penthouses. But this used to be Coliseum, the first home of Twice as Nice.
And yet there's little fragments of it. Just down that way, you've got the Greenwich Millennium Village, one of those kind of prototypical Blairite mixed communities where most of it is very expensive private flats for Canary Wharf workers. You've also got Canary Wharf itself just over there. You know, the kind of, I think, the symbol of the financial boom, and I guess given that Lehman Brothers' offices
in the UK just over there, the symbol of its collapse. Vibe, a different energy. You remember now, everything's so accessible. Music we can download, we don't even have to own it, we can have it and play it on our phones. Where back then, you had to go to the source to get what you want.
Kind of acres of luxury flats and former industrial lands. And you've got the eventual transformation of this into something which I think initially wanted to be a version of continental Europe. Of kind of sustainable environmental architecture and good public transport and a mix of different people living in the same areas, to, I guess, a sort of botched thing somewhere between
festivals,
somewhere between that and, the
big
USA
celebration, but you need to have the nuts and bolts, and I think that's what Clubland gives you. It's hard to have a scene without a Clubland, without a healthy Clubland where people can go hear, test, try out music, where something can grow.
The Dome is now, you know, the O2 kind of Las Vegas style, the Normo Dome, you know, ringed by car parks, ringed by flyovers, and you've got the kind of total kind of giving over of an area that was formerly industrial to the service industry. Because the current government have abandoned, I guess, the idea of urban regeneration, partly because they're not an urban party. You know, apart from the Royal Borough of Kensington and Chelsea, there's very few inner city areas that ever have voted Tory or really ever will. So I think they're going back to their comfort zone. It's interesting that the kind of localism stuff has been combined with the return of the enterprise zone. And I think that shows what localism really is. I think a few people seem to have the idea that localism is this kind of passport to Pimlico, you know, kind of farmers markets and cottage industries thing. And I think it's quite deceptive. I think what localism is part of a kind of many-pronged assault on the planning system. And partly as a way of getting the building industry and the kind of property boom and the whole...
Yeah, quite remarkable, but this is London, like I said. The club owner's gone, wait a minute, I can have 150 flats overlooking the River Thames. Why am I going through licensing arguments and people being drunk in my venue?
If you just lift planning regulations, make it very, very cheap to build, make it very, very low tax, this stuff will happen. And so I think regeneration boils down really to let's get the middle class and let's get investment back into central cities. I think the central problem with that was that meant accepting a situation which had occurred through the 80s and 90s, in which working class areas and working class housing had been dilapidated and poorly treated and so on and so forth. And the only solution to this would seem to be, first of all, let's get doctors and stockbrokers living next door to these people, because that will make them better. And secondly, that will then lead to a trickle-down effect. And trickle-down economics is one of the greatest kind of economic fantasies, I think, of the last century, really.
And what I will say to anyone who's going out now and enjoying it is enjoy it to the max, because you don't know what the future holds. One day you might walk down this road and that place where you had some of your best nights, your best times, will no longer be there. Document it and enjoy it. We'll be right back.
Amongst the greatest and the goodest were leaders of industry, politicians, television executives and property developers. The quote raises at least two questions. Firstly, why are the great and the good suddenly so keen to be associated with contemporary art? And secondly, what kind of marginal role can artists expect for themselves in the rebranded New Art World Order of London? Most artists have a long way to go before they can claim professional status. Apart from the few stars that the art market's winners-takes-all economy can sustain, most artists either practice other professions, have a private income, or rely on state benefits. Much art activity is run on a voluntary basis, with little consideration for contracts, rates of pay, or conditions of service. Strictly speaking, most artists are just about on a par with skilled manual labourers rather than associate professionals.
With the surge to merge in full swing and the shift to a service-based culture industry, a new type of artist will emerge who claims professional status as a broker, a mediator rather than a producer, artists as liaison, speaking directly to politicians, television executives, bankers and property developers. Arguably, the 90s set the ground for artist careerism and artist celebrity, as well as the contradictions of the artist's position in society. Read precarity and gentrification.
So we're going to leave it there. This is Free Cash Presents.
Ruth Angel Edwards.
And Adam Gallagher. Not coming from Wising this time. We're in our studio.
Thanks, Montez.
Thanks, Wising.
See ya.
See you next time.
See ya.
Young people graduating around that time, kind of, I can see why they would want to
do away with like having to continually sort of address that in a like head-on sort of political way, or to feel that they should have to. So maybe this like quite puerile, like quite playful kind of, however you want to view it, was like quite refreshing or quite freeing.
But also in the 80s, music wise, loads of people like made it, without a comment. There wasn't an art world in the 80s, a British art world in the same sense, you know?
The same sense as now and the same sense as it's in
like
the 90s.
A lot of the way it's described is that the art world in its current times was invented in the 90s.
Yeah. Even when we went to uni and stuff like that, still like the ideas of what you might be expected to achieve, however unrealistic, maybe we're still in relation to that kind of 90s legacy.
Yeah.
And that's probably some of the tutors that we would have and all this kind of thing. Kind of like lived their formative years through that era as well.
Mm. Actually, most of the teachers at uni.
Yeah, exactly. Even if, like, whether they were, like, you know, part of that to some degree or whether they totally rejected it. It was shaped kind of like what they had to teach.
Who have you got so far?
Got a very dry Mark Wallinger.
Yeah,
looks quite hungover. It's kind of, I don't know, I haven't got stuck into it properly yet because it's just like watching all of the old, it's quite enjoyable watching like the early press that the YBA's got, because it's just very like, I don't know, quite exciting, and you can see like, yeah, like Tracy Emin and Sarah Lucas like partying and like doing interviews a bit drunk and stuff like that. And it just seems quite fun.
I burnt my tongue.
Oh no, on the pie.
Did you?
Well,